Today we're going to be looking at one of the women in the Old Testament. The long title of the series is The Power of the Powerless, in quotations, Women Who Shaped Biblical History. And the reason that I called the series The Power of the Powerless is because what we're studying when we look at the Old Testament is a patriarchal society. Patriarchal, meaning that the power is held in the hands of the fathers. So the economic, political, social power structurally is concentrated in the males' hands. However, when we look at these stories, we find that women were very powerful in shaping biblical history. And yesterday we looked at the story of Rebecca and saw what a dominant personality she was and how she directed the course of the blessing, the promise, which is seen as going through a certain genealogical line in the Old Testament. The stories that we're looking at are folk legends. They're stories of a particular people and how they came to be who they are. So we have to keep that in mind when we look at them, too. And so today we're going to look at another of these folk stories, and this is the story of Tamar and Judah. This is in Genesis 38, so let's open up to Genesis 38 here and jump right in. This story of Judah and Tamar hasn't been emphasized very much in the Christian church. And also, Tamar isn't a figure that's often quoted or held up in books that contain collections of women of the Bible. This is possibly because it's a strange story, a very strange story. And there's a lot that's offensive to modern sensibilities. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who wrote the Woman's Bible in the late 19th century, she said, "This story is immoral," and she did not include it in her discussion. On the other hand, more recent voices have really appreciated the figure of Tamar. For example, I don't know how many of you have ever seen this book. It's the Book of Jay. Maybe some of you have heard it being discussed. I don't know, it was discussed on public radio a while back. The Book of Jay, there's a number of different sources in the Old Testament. Different sources were used to create what we know as the Old Testament. And one of the sources, which is in the Book of Genesis, is known as the Yahwist. And the Yahwist in German, instead of starting with a Y, it would have started with a J, so that's why they call it J, the J source. The Yahwist always used the name of God, Yahweh, used as the name of God, Yahweh, which is translated in your Bibles now as Lord, because this became too sacred a name to pronounce. So when you see the word Lord in most translations, that's Yahweh. So anyway, the Yahwist source contains a lot of very interesting legends and so forth. And this story here in Genesis 38 is from this J source, or the Yahwist. And Harold Bloom, instead of calling the story immoral, he's looking at it from a literary point of view. He says, "Of all J's heroines, Tamar is the most vivid and the most revelatory of J's identity, both as a woman and as a literary ironist of high civilization and intense sophistication." One of the controversial things about Harold Bloom is he claims that the Yahwist stories are written by a woman because they have a feminist perspective. He actually doesn't make that claim hard and fast. He says, we'll never know who really wrote these stories. But he thinks that because the perspective is so, so very strongly in favor of these strong women, that perhaps she was a woman. I don't know.
Since Jay's heroines are more admirable than her male protagonists, I will go further and observe that Tamar, despite her brief appearance in only a single chapter, Genesis 38, is the most memorable character in the book of Jay. So there's a very strong statement, too. She says, Tamar is a triumph of Jay's elliptical style, understated style, in which so little is said overtly and so much expressed through the reticence of character and situation. Okay, so now we'll look at the story itself, and that's enough commentary. And I think you will notice that, although strange story it is, there's no negative evaluation of the activities of Tamar. Let's divide this story up, and we will read it straight through, and then we'll go back and we'll talk about some of the things that are difficult to understand in it. The story follows directly on the heels of the story of the sale of Joseph into slavery in chapter 37. If you remember, there's the 12 brothers, Joseph's the favorite one, and his father sends him dressed up in this nice cloak, colored cloak, striped cloak, to check up on his brothers. They see him coming and they're really sick of him, and so they decide to kill him. But his brother Reuben, first of all, says, no, let's not kill him. Let's just put him in this pit for a while. And then a caravan passes, and Judah, another of the brothers, says, well, let's sell him to these guys in this caravan here. You know, there's no profit in killing him. Let's just sell him. So they sell their brother, and then they lie to their father. They kill a kid, and they dip the coat in the blood, take it to the father, and say, well, is this Joseph's coat? And the father then concludes that Joseph has been killed. So this is what's happened right before this story. And here, Judah, who's just sold his brother into slavery, not too good an action there. Now we have a depiction of his later life. So if somebody would read Genesis 38, 1 through 11. And please tell us what translation of the Bible you're using so that we know.
New RSV. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and settled near a certain Adullamite whose name was Hirah. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he married her and went into her. She conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Again she conceived and bore a son, whom she named Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she named him Shelah. She was in Chezib when she bore him. Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her. Raise up offspring for your brother. But since Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, he spilled his semen on the ground wherever he went, whenever he went into his brother's wife, so that he would not give offspring to his brother. What he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up, for he feared that he too would die like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's house.
Okay, thanks. So Tamar's living in her father's house. Someone continue here from 12 down to 23.
The New Revised Standard Version. In course of the time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah's time of mourning was over, he went up to Timnah with his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, she put off her widow's garments, put on a veil, wrapped herself up, and sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. She saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He went over to her at the roadside and said, come, let me come in to you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? He answered, I will send you a kid from the flock. And she said, only if you give me a pledge until you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet and your cord and the staff that is in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she got up and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood.
Why don't you read down to 23?
Okay, when Judah sent the kid by his friend the Adullamite to recover the pledge from the woman, he could not find her. He asked the townspeople, "Where is the temple prostitute who was in him by the wayside?" But they said, "No prostitute has been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I have not found her." Moreover, the townspeople said, "No prostitute has been here." Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own. Otherwise, we'll be laughed at. You see, I sent this kid and you could not find her."
Okay, great, thanks. So now the plot thickens here. Can somebody read from 24 to the end? You have the climax and then the denouement here.
The New King James. And it came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry." So Judah said, "Bring her out, let her be burned." When she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." And she said, "Please determine whose these are, the signet and cord and staff." So Judah acknowledged them and said, "She has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah my son," and he never knew her again. Now it came to pass at the time for giving birth that, behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was, when she was given birth, that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." Then it happened, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly, and she said, "How did you break through? This breach be upon you." Therefore his name was called Perez. Afterward his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. How many of you have heard this story before? Few? Mm-hmm. Okay. Those of you who haven't heard it before, what's your initial reaction? Any initial reactions? No initial reaction. Strange story, don't you think? Mm-hmm. Very strange story. All right. Well, let's unpack some of the things that are going on here. First of all, you have Judah going down and marrying a Canaanite without any ceremony. Now, this is rather odd in the first place, because if you remember yesterday, we were talking about marriages, and Abraham sent his servant up north to get a wife for his son Isaac from the family. He didn't want Isaac to marry anybody locally. He wanted to have that family tie still. He didn't want assimilation into the general population there. And then also Rebecca, she decides that she wants her son Jacob also to marry into the family, so she sends Jacob back up, or she has Isaac send Jacob back up so that he marries one of the family members too, so that Jacob doesn't marry a Canaanite or one of the locals. But here, without any ceremony, Judah marries a Canaanite. Rather odd story here. Perhaps this legend is from a time so far back that this wasn't a prohibition, but rather, it expresses the reality that the southern tribe of Judah is composed, actually, of an ethnically diverse group of people. Very interesting here. Well, he has 3 sons. And then we have the problem of getting a wife for Er, and we are introduced to Tamar. No genealogy here. She's kind of out of the blue. Tamar. The first son dies, and we have then the introduction of this practice, which is known as the Levirate marriage. So Judah tells his son, "Join with your brother's wife and do your duty to her as a brother-in-law and provide offspring for your brother." Now, in this society,
the sons of a man were seen as the continuation of his identity, and the sons would inherit the property, and the firstborn actually would inherit a double portion of the property. That's the birthright of the firstborn, which we discussed yesterday also. Well, here, notice there's three sons. There's Er, Onan, and Shelah. Er is dead. The firstborn's dead. So the firstborn now is Onan. So he gets a double piece of the inheritance. Very handy. But now his father's telling him, go have sex with your sister-in-law so that she conceives and has a son, and therefore her son will inherit like the firstborn, because it'll be considered a son of Er. So this is bad business sense for the second son here, who's become the first son, you see. So he introduces his practice of spilling his seed. You know, Dorothy Parker had a parakeet. The author Dorothy Parker had a parakeet, and she named him Onan because he spilled his seed. Oh. So if you ever need a name for a parakeet, a messy parakeet, there Onan is a good candidate. But let's look briefly at two other instances of this law, which seems to be a setting aside of an incest taboo for the sake of the perpetuation of the name of the older brother here. Let's look at Deuteronomy 25.
Numbers what?
Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10.
From the RSV. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in to her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his brother who is dead, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of this city shall call him and speak to him. And if he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face, and she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called in Israel the house of him that had his sandal pulled off.
How would you like that name? The house of him who had his sandal pulled off. All right, so this is the most clear articulation of this Levirate law, providing sons for the dead brother. Notice there is a way out, but it's not very well respected. It's shameful here. You get spit in the face in public, and then you get called a name for the rest of your life. This whole idea of pulling off the sandal, rather foreign to us also. This is a way of making business deals in the ancient context here. And there's a good example of that if we look at Ruth 4. Ruth 4. Now, in the story of Ruth, is about a man and his wife who during a famine leave Judah. They go into Moab because of the famine. And their two sons marry Moabite women. Then all the males die. The husband, the two sons die. And so there are the three women there in Moab. There's Naomi, the older, the wife of Elimelech, the husband. And then her two Moabite daughter-in-laws, Ruth and Orpah. And she decides to go back to her hometown, and she encourages her Moabite daughter-in-law to stay there. But Ruth decides to go with her, and is very loyal, comes, makes the journey back, and provides for her mother-in-law there in Bethlehem. Well, finally, her mother-in-law, Naomi, remembers, oh yeah, we have this relative named Boaz. So what I want you to do is I want you to get all dressed up, and at night, after the guy's had something to drink, and he's feeling pretty good, go down there where he is at the threshing floor, this is during the harvest season, and lie down at his feet and do whatever he tells you to do. Now, this isn't exactly what my mother told me to do on dates, but it's a very powerful way of getting a guy's attention, I guess. Anyway, so she makes it down there, and he says, oh, you know, you really touched my heart. That's really sweet. I'm kind of an old guy. You could have gone after all these young people around here. But he says, you know, I'm really honored, but there is one person who's a closer relative, so we have to check this out with him, too, this whole arrangement, because there's also some property involved. It's not clear exactly how this property is related to in this case, but since the wife did not inherit the property of the of her husband, but rather it went through the sons, in this kind of transaction, there was property involved also. So they go, Boaz goes to the city gate, which is kind of like the town hall, and he asks this closer relative if he wants to marry Ruth. Well, actually, he asks him if he wants to redeem this property, if he wants to buy this family property, and if he wants to marry Ruth. But he says, no, it's going to somehow impair my inheritance and so forth, so I don't want to get into that. So this is how this is what happened here. And it's clear that already by the time Ruth was written, this law or this custom of pulling off the sandal and so forth was no longer known. So you see kind of the layers of history here in the Bible in this passage here. If you read from 4:7 on to 4:10, that would be super. Anybody who hasn't read, maybe?
Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was a manner of attesting in Israel. So when the next of kin said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said, the elders and all people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon.
Mm-hmm, those are the two sons. Mm-hmm.
Also Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetrate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among the brethren and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day.
Mm-hmm, great. And why don't you continue reading here 11 and 12, because this bears on our passage too.
Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you prosper in Ephrata and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah, because the children of the Lord will give you by this young woman.
Okay, great. So this is the other example that we have of this Levirate type of exchange, exchanging the sandal, and he acquires both the property and Ruth. But notice that there's a mention here of the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah also, as a positive thing. So Tamar is evaluated as a positive figure in this later book of the Bible, interestingly enough. Whatever our morality is, certainly there wasn't that kind of negative evaluation of anything she did in Genesis 38, and there's no negative evaluation in other chapters too. Mm-hmm.
Why is the son who is born to Boaz mm-hmm. named Obed, when it's actually supposed to be, according to the book, the son of Mahlon?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of confused me too, in that in the genealogies that we'll look at later also, the sons that are born, Perez and Zerah, are considered sons of Judah. So maybe they were just considered sons of the deceased brother in inheritance rights.
Okay.
That's always been a little bit strange to me too, because you know you have the Levirate law that says so the name will be perpetuated, but they're never listed as sons of the
and
dead.
And they're not
brother.
Given the name of the dead person.
No, mm-mm. No, they aren't. Yeah, it's interesting, but perhaps it was just in property.
But did Boaz actually take her as his wife, not just performing his brother's duties?
Mm-hmm.
But. Performing the brother's duty, I think, meant marrying her, didn't it?
Yeah. See, it was not a monogamous culture for the men, so you could have a number of wives. And in Deuteronomy 25, also it says the first son is going to belong to the be in the line of inheritance of the dead brother, but the other sons that are born won't. So it seems to be acquiring a second wife. Now, see, this is important because what's the official status of women in that society? First of all, you belong to your father's household, and at a particular time, then you're married into another family, and you leave your father's household and go to that other family, and then they're responsible for you. So then, ideally, you'd have some sons, and then you'd have sort of a place within that family, because the property would pass to your sons, and they would take care of you also, you know, as you grew old and so forth. Now, the problem would be is if your husband would die before you had any children, it'd be better if you had sons, but okay, there's an exception made in Numbers that the daughters can inherit if there are no sons, but okay, you'd like to have sons. If you don't have any children, there's a problem because you don't really have a place within the society. First of all, you're in your in-laws' settlement or whatever in their family, but
you can't inherit.
You don't inherit any of the property yourself, and so you're an anomaly. You're in no man's land when you need a man, you know, in that society. Mm-hmm. And so this provision of the Levirate law is made so that these women are taken care of. It's kind of a double duty thing. It provides offspring and a way for the male line to continue, but also it provides a place for the woman within the society. She's incorporated and kept into her husband's household. So it's kind of a social insurance policy, a social security policy in a way.
Would it also be that if a woman brought along a dowry, that the family would have to give back her dowry if she was sent back to her family?
It doesn't state anything about that in these laws, so I don't. All we know really is what we have in these laws, so I can't answer your question. Sorry about that. Well, anyway, so there's a little background there. So Judah gives Onan. Gives her to Onan, but Onan doesn't cooperate, so he's struck down here. So there's only one more chance, Shelah. And notice, Judah, it's Judah's responsibility, since that's his daughter-in-law. It's his responsibility to take care of her. But he says, well, you know, stay a widow until my son grows up, Shelah grows up. So he's promising her that third chance, but actually it seems like he has no intention of filling her. His promise, because he's thinking, well, you know, this woman, she marries the boys and they die. Something's going on in there.
Isn't there somebody in Tobit
that's like that? Right, yeah, in the book of Tobit, there's a woman named Sarah, the daughter of Raul, I think it is.
And she keeps killing her husbands, they think, or something.
Right, she's had seven husbands, and every time on her marriage night, there's this demon named Asmodeus who is jealous of the husbands and kills them. And so poor Sarah goes around crying all the time because she's lost all these husbands. And Tobias, the son of Tobit, shows up, and he's been instructed by one of the angels. He says, I found a perfect wife for you. And Sarah, and the angel says, well, you know,
this is a perfect wife for you. Seven of her husbands have died, but perfect wife for you. And he's like, oh no, what am I going to do? But the angel gives him some special ointments made of like fish eyes and the gallbladder and stuff. So he has like these kind of potions. And so Tobias shows up at the house of Raul and Sarah, and he says, hi, I'd like to marry your daughter. And Sarah starts crying because she knows what's going to happen. And the father-in-law is like, well, you want to marry my daughter? Well, you know, seven of her husbands have died. But Tobias says, no, I want to marry her. And so they say, okay, fine. They have a big banquet and stuff. And then they put them in the bridal chamber, you know, together. And then Raul, the father, he goes out and he starts digging the grave. So he's out there. But this time, Tobias, he gets out his fish ointments and he burns some incense and stuff, and the demon like goes away. And they spend the whole night praying. And so they make it through the night. And when they come out, you know, the father has already come out and they're astonished. So he's found his perfect wife. So yeah, there is that. There are a lot of other legends and stories, folk tales of the man-slaying woman who sleeps with men and knocks them off. But actually this, it seems from Judah's point of view that Tamar is this kind of woman, but the narrator makes it very clear to us that she's not, that it's not the woman's fault, that this is the Lord coming down every once in a while and kind of bumping off these people. But anyway, so he's scared for his third son, and so he stalls. And he stalls so long, we learn that Shelah grows up and he's not given to Tamar. We also learn then that Judah's wife has died, which maybe makes his relations with Tamar a little bit more palatable, but also it indicates that he might be lonely on his way to the sheep shearing. And the sheep shearing during this time was a great celebration, as harvest and other agricultural events are in an agrarian society. So you had a lot of drinking of wine and, you know, social interaction between people and so forth. So in this context, he goes up and sees this woman, and she's covered her face. It's interesting that the narrator never says that she pretends to be a prostitute or that she became a prostitute or anything like that. It just says that she disguised herself and sat on the road. And it's Judah then that says, huh, looks like a prostitute here. And uses this word, zona, for prostitute. Actually, the word zona can mean any kind of a person who engages in any kind of unauthorized sexual activity, adultery, what else do you have here, incest, all kinds of things like this. That general term, fornication, you know, it's kind of an old-fashioned term, but it sort of covers all the bases. That's what this term refers to. Later on, when he's looking for this woman, his friend, the Adullamite, Hira, inquires of the town people if there's been a Kadesha, a priestess. So sometimes they translate it as cult prostitute or whatever. And we know from Akkadian literature at that time, there was an official called the Kadishtu. They were higher-ranking women, priestesses, often involved in things like childbirth rituals and things like that, and apparently also participating in sacred marriage rituals and so forth, but a very well-respected priestess, actually. So it's interesting that when the Adullamite goes and looks for the woman and inquires from the people around, is the priestess around? Mm-hmm. It sort of dignifies, perhaps, Judah's participation in this kind of activity or whatever. Because it's very clear that he doesn't want to be a laughingstock. He doesn't want people to make fun of him. So two different terms here for this, what Tamar is perceived to be. Okay, notice that in their interaction, Tamar is very crafty here. She's decided that nothing's happening here. Judah has been ineffectual, and
there's going to be a discontinuity in the line here. So she's going to make sure this happens. Also, she's going to claim what's hers by right, a place in the family that's been denied to her by Judah. So when Judah asks her if she'll sleep with him, she's very smart. She says, okay, well, what will you give me? And then she doesn't settle with him until he gives her some very important items. Says the seal and the cord. Now, the seal or the signet was a piece of clay that had some markings in it that you would roll, and it would be your special identifying mark on letters or on whatever you would write. And it would be comparable today to our driver's license or your Visa or MasterCard, something like that. Something that would show that, your passport maybe, you know, something that would show beyond a shadow of doubt that you were who you claimed to be. So it was an identifying object, and it was generally hung around your neck with a cord. And then she also asked for his staff, and that often had an insignia on it too. She was asking for pieces of identification, basically, from him. And when she gets those, then they go ahead and have intercourse, and she quickly goes away and goes back home, and it's as if nothing ever happened. Judah has this one-night fling, and he tries to pay for his interaction, but he gives up on that too. Once again, he doesn't follow through on what he's promised because he doesn't want to be embarrassed by the people. So, but then we have 3 months later, the consequences of their relations are made clear, and Tamar is pregnant. So notice here, Judah has full rights here as the leader of his household. He can make a decision concerning his daughter-in-law. He could just say, okay, bring her out, burn her. Well, I think it's kind of humorous myself. We don't quite operate like that anyway. But that gives you an indication of the authority that the father, this patriarchal figurehead, would have within his household. He could say, okay, yeah, burn her. And then later when he finds out, I was responsible for this thing. He can say, okay, don't burn her. So he had that kind of power within his household here. So she produces these identifying objects, and he has to admit, you know, she was more in the right than I was. She's more righteous than I, because I should have given her Sheila. So he recognizes that she went beyond him in ensuring that the line was continued, and that she got what she rightly deserved here. And then notice you go into the depiction of the birth of the twins. Now that reminds us, if you were here yesterday, of the birth of the twins of Rebekah. And I think this motif of the birth of twins applied here, it ties her to the figure of Rebekah, and in more ways than one. First of all, there's that reversal of the order, and the midwife ties a crimson thread on the hand of the one that comes out first, so that redness too of the firstborn is brought over into here. It's rather strange. We were talking last time about type scenes. You know, that there's kind of recurrent patterns that happen in these narratives. And this is, it seems to be one, the birth of twins and the reversal of their birth order in the in their importance. Mm-hmm.
Now, Perez and Judah, then, does Perez and Zerah, which one of them is the firstborn to Judah, though?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a little...
They are the firstborn instead of Sheila. Sheila now goes down to the bottom of the line again.
Right, mm-hmm, that's right. Mm-hmm. And we'll look at the genealogies here in a minute too, and see what we find from that.
Now,
but
are they Judah's sons? Or are they your son's sons?
Heirs' sons. Mm-hmm. Well, according to the Levirate law, you'd expect them to be heirs' sons. But if we'll look at the genealogies, and they're included under Judah's sons. Mm-hmm.
But they are taking the place of heir.
Well, let's look at the genealogies. So I don't have to. Let's look at Ruth 4, 18 through 22. We're in Ruth 4, 18 through 22. And I'll read that to you. Yeah. Unless somebody really wants to read it. Okay. This is the line of...
Is Perez one of the twins then?
Right. Uh-huh. Perez is one of the twins. And actually, he's the one without the crimson cord. So one of the twins stuck his hand out and got a crimson cord. So I think that was the firstborn, you know, because he emerged first, but then he pulled back. And then Perez was born. And Perez's name means breaking through. So he's kind of a one who breaks through in an unexpected way. So this is the line of Perez. So Perez becomes the important one here, even though he's officially the second born. We've had that pattern too in, with Jacob and Esau. Esau is the oldest, but Jacob ends up taking the birthright and the blessing. So this is the line of Perez. Perez begot Hezron, Hezron begot Ram, Ram begot Amminadab, Amminadab begot Nahshon, Nahshon begot Salmon, Salmon begot Boaz, Boaz begot Obed, Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. The origin of the Davidic line. This is a story about the origins of the Davidic line, way back in Genesis. In rather unexpected fashion here. So Tamar's actions are indispensable in this story of the creation of the Davidic line. Let's also look at 1 Chronicles 2. In 1 Chronicles 1 and 2, you have history as genealogy here. Lists of sons of sons and so forth. 1 Chronicles 2. These are the sons of Israel, and then it names the 12 sons. And then it goes directly to the sons of Judah. Because for the writer of Chronicles, the important line was the line of Judah. Chronicles was written after the return from Babylonian exile, and the important tribe at that time was Judah, and they had a lot of interest in the Davidic line. So Judah's highlighted right away. The sons of Judah, Er, Onan, and Shelah. These three, Bathsheba, the Canaanite woman, bore to him. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was displeasing to the Lord, and he took his life. His daughter-in-law Tamar also bore him Perez and Zerah. Judah's sons were five in all. So they're considered Judah's sons. And if we go on, Perez is the one son that's picked up in this section. And once again, that line ends with David. If you look at 2:15, David's considered the seventh son of Jesse here. He's the eighth son of Jesse in 1 Samuel, but here's the seventh son. Okay, so we have here a story of the origin of the Davidic line. And Tamar is really the heroine of the story, the one who brings it about, makes it possible, because Judah hasn't kept his promise and has been ineffectual in making this line continue. You know, there's a lot of stories in mythology about incest at the origin of either of the human race or incest at the origins of a people. Sometimes you have a brother and a sister, the original two people, and then they mate, and you know, you have all human beings being created. In the Bible, you have sort of a remnant of that in the story about Abraham and Sarah, where Abraham's calling her the sister. But also, you can see it more clearly in the story of Lot and his daughters. After the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot and his two daughters, they go up to the hills, and the daughters think, oh, there's no men around here. What's going to happen? The human race is going to be annihilated. And so they get their father drunk, and they sleep with him on successive nights, and he never knew what happened. You know, that they become pregnant, and they bear sons, and the sons are the ancestors of the Moabite people and the Edomite people. So that's a story of the creation of peoples through incest that's in the Hebrew Bible. And I think that you have a little bit of a remnant of that in this story, the story of Tamar and Judah.
That was fairly common in most Near East or ancient Near East mythology too, wasn't it?
Some of the incest.
Some of the Canaanite mythology had a lot to do with Baal and Anat.
And Baal and Anat. Mm-hmm. Baal and Anat were sister and brother, mm-hmm. and they were also consorts or lovers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's sort of divine incest. But here we have on the level, the human, kind of a human level.
But I brought that up just saying that again, it may show sort of the Hebrew mimicking of the sort of present mythology that was around at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Good point. All right, so a strange story, I'd say. What do you make of this story? Any reactions you have or questions about it? You want to raise? This is a quiet class.
Yeah. It seems that she almost had a vision of what was to be, mm-hmm. you know, and that she felt the responsibility of that.
Mm-hmm. So she acted out of a sense of responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I found it interesting what was considered to be Judah's crime. You know, just the fact that he didn't provide for Tamar with his son, whereas there seems, for us, there seems to be a whole slew of moral issues that are much, much more important than the fact that he didn't provide Tamar with his son.
Mm-hmm, exactly. When we read it with our kind of Victorian ethics, you know, sexual ethics, there's, first of all, the whole idea of levirate marriage is really bizarre. And then you have a Tamar dressing up and the perception that she's a prostitute, and then, you know, sex outside marriage, and Judah's consortium with prostitutes. But none of this is really condemned within the story itself. In fact, you know, it's, okay, this is what happened, and this is how our Davidic line was begun. And in Ruth, you know, may your house be like the house of Perez, which Tamar bore to Judah. She's seen as a positive figure in establishing a line.
And I have a question, too. It just says, about 3 months later, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the whore. Moreover, she is pregnant as a result of whoredom. If it's not okay for women to be whores, but the men are looking for them, I'm wondering who is okay to be a whore? You know, when weren't you going to get burned for it?
Oh. When you're not involved in a family.
Oh.
And that, I think that it's the family connection that's the real problem. You're introducing something that shouldn't be. That's why the incest and the marrying someone outside the family is such a terrible crime, and that's why people do it, because they're fascinated by the idea, even though they know they should reject it. And so it's that combination of repulsion, attraction, it makes it highly exciting. I think
incest?
That, yeah, and all the other things that are happening, yeah. Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about what their choices are, but I think, you know, God intervened too.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's his intervention through these people, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Didn't he predict that the Lord was going to come from the house of David? That the Lord had said that Jesus was going to
mm-hmm.
the house of David?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there... And so this, don't you think this was his way of bringing the line down?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Matthew, if you look at the genealogy in Matthew, Matthew 1, you might want to turn there. There's the genealogy of Jesus and Tamar. There are four women that are included in the genealogy. Tamar is one of them. That's in Matthew 1, first chapter. Tamar is one. You also have Rahab. We'll look at her later. And you have Ruth. We've mentioned Ruth. And then also you have the wife of Uriah, or Bathsheba. So those four women are included. And people have always wondered about those four women. They seem to be foreigners, although it's never mentioned that Ruth's a foreigner. Do you want to speak to that?
No, go ahead. I was okay. Just going to add something else.
Okay, good. Let me just finish this. Okay, these four women. What are these four women doing in the genealogy of Jesus, which is a male genealogy? So some say, okay, they're foreigners, which shows that Jesus included women, foreigners in the history. Some have said, well, these are all sinners, which kind of applies our morality on them, and Jesus came to save sinners. I would say that each one of these women, well, we'd have to look at the traditions about Rahab. That's not biblical, but the other women were very active in making sure that this line continued, even though it seems like the males were letting it kind of drop. And so they were very active participants in bringing about the continuation of the line, which is so important in this whole view of the world and the kind of a channel of God's promise. So, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say a couple things. It does get to this whole question that you and I were talking about yesterday about sort of the relevance of all these Old Testament characters who are so removed from us to our faith. Because I find myself, when I read all these stories, saddened, I guess, or at least feeling really distant, that kind of the only way that you could be a person of faith back in those times was to have children. That was the absolutely most important thing. The one letter in the New Testament picks that up, 1 Timothy, by saying women are going to be saved through bearing children, and I find that really almost offensive, that that's such a narrow way of salvation for women. On the other hand, I do really like the fact that if these people are our genealogy as well, as people of faith, we own them as our fathers and mothers of the faith, that it wasn't like the perfect happy family along the way, you know, with every generation working perfectly and all the children obedient, and that they're this sort of pious, saintly family, that I take heart from the fact that there are odd figures in every generation of our genealogy of faith, and that they weren't suppressed either. I mean, that Matthew singles them out too, that there were, that these people had troubles in their lives. They didn't follow what seemed to be the ideal of just having these perfect children, that they themselves made mistakes too, and were sinners, and I find that comforting. I have a lot of relatives that aren't perfect, including myself, and so it's nice to know that in the Bible also our relatives aren't perfect.
But isn't that what's good about the Bible? It shows us the warts and all.
But it does seem like these women, I'm speaking specifically of Tamar and Bathsheba, are atoned simply by the fact that they did have kids, you know. I don't know what the law says about being a harlot for a woman, but she's obviously forgiven that sin and atoned by the fact that she had babies and sort of continued the Davidic line.
Yeah, I don't think she ever really is a harlot. You know, she tricks her father-in-law, but it's clear that her purpose is to exact justice from him and also to continue the line. So I don't think she ever really is, actually. So I don't think she needs any atonement. And Judah certainly doesn't think she does either. He says, oh, she was right. Okay.
But even in this, the only one case in the Bible where I can think of where there's a single line is the case of Isaac, when Abraham's going to sacrifice his son, when he's long past the age of childbirth now, even older than he was when he had his son. But in every case, there's, after all, there was another son named Shelah.
Well, there's another son named Ishmael, too.
Yeah, but I mean, not of Sarah's line. That was part of the promise. And I think that in every case, the line would have continued without Bathsheba, without Ruth, without Tamar.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the way they tell the story, though.
No, it's not the way they tell the story. But I mean, the story always seems to say, even if this had not happened, that would not have invalidated God's promise. You know, that, so it's not simply that this had to happen. This was the way it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
But not the only way it could have happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a story of how it happened, how they saw promise continuing. You know what, we've raised a number of very interesting points here, and I think, for me, in my understanding of this material, I also look at this as our adopted story, because it is, as I said, it's folk legends from an ancient culture. I mean, imagine, and most of us aren't Jewish, in any ethnic sense of the word. And so we've sort of adopted this material as our own heritage, our own religious story of faith. And it was a decision by the church in the second century, actually. There was this guy named Marcion who said, this isn't our story, you know. Let's just have Paul's letters. They talk about liberty of the spirit and so forth. You know, let's just have Paul's letters. Get rid of this other stuff. This isn't our story. We have a universal approach to salvation and so forth, and we have this freedom in Christ. But the majority of the church fathers said, no, this is our story. You know, Jesus came out of this tradition, and this becomes part of our tradition. So we've had these stories and adopted these stories as our own. And when I look at them now, you have to almost kind of take on the perspective of the writers and this whole idea of male genealogy. Okay, that's almost like a given structure of the patriarchal society. But what I find fascinating, more so than that, that the structures themselves may be very oppressive, and we may say, you know, this is not right that these women, you know, are only like bearers of male sons and stuff like that. But what I find most significant about these stories is that the women are portrayed by the authors not as mere handmaidens of the male, you know, line or whatever, but they're very active in making it possible where the men, like Isaac, for example, was kind of a weakling, and Judah was he was kind of an unsavory character, selling his brother and then, you know, not taking care of his daughter-in-law. The men fail, but it's the women that are depicted in these two cases anyway as the strong ones who do continue this kind of possibility of promise. So within the patriarchal structures, which are very clear, the women are depicted as very strong and powerful. And then I wanted to say something about women as childbearers too. It's interesting that, I mean, that was very important in this culture, but it's interesting that the motif of the barren wife appears time and time and again, and it's actually, the barren wife's the preferred wife in cases where there is a barren wife and a fertile wife. So if you think of Sarah, you know, is loved by Abraham, and if you think of then Rebecca, very, very much loved by Isaac. If you think of Rachel, she was the preferred one, even though Leah had lots of kids, and so, you know, you think that she was like the ideal wife in those times, but Rachel was the preferred one. She was barren. Hannah, also the mother of Samuel, was barren, and she had another rival wife, co-wife, who had a lot of kids. And Hannah's husband says, Hannah, don't be so sad. Am I not enough for you? You know, we have a relationship. So she was the preferred one. So what I find interesting is that within these structures, patriarchal structures, the literature itself portrays the women as very decisive and very powerful, and almost provides an internal critique, I think, of the idea that you know, men rule the world and men are the strong ones and women are just sort of secondary citizens or whatever. Yeah.
Do most of these stories come from the J. Strand? In
Rebecca does, too. Mm-hmm. The story of Rebecca does. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them do, and that's why Harold Bloom, I mean, I think he's trying to be provocative in the Book of Jay also, but he says, okay, yeah, I think she's a feminist because if you look at her women characters, they're often stronger than the men characters. So, and he points that out in a number of cases. Barb?
Do you recommend that book, The Book of Jay?
I think it's fun. Yeah, it really is. Uh-huh. Because, you know, if you take classes in college or in seminary about the Old Testament, that we keep telling people, well, yeah, there are different strands of traditions, and you like identify different strands. Now, this is from the J source. This is from the E source. But the good thing about this is it just it takes out those stories that are considered J. And there's some controversial things that the translation is pretty loose, and you may dispute where it's J and so forth. But it's really fun to just read the narratives that are J as a group and just separate them out. So yeah, you might want to look at it. And then Harold Bloom has this commentary too, which is kind of fun. So, yeah. So what do other people make of this these ancient stories? Oh, does anybody have any closing remarks here? It is 10 o'clock. No? It doesn't strike your imagination?
Certainly
good. Oh, okay. All right, thanks a lot. Come back tomorrow for exploring the exercise.